If someone says that you've done something terrible and has no proof that you did that terrible thing, well, you might very well sue that person, and you might very well collect damages for a tort that's commonly called defamation. If it's spoken, it's slander. If it's written, it's libel. But either way, you could get money. But what if the person in question, the one accusing you of that terrible thing, happens to be named Donald J. Trump? What if he is the president of the United States? Can you sue the president, or is he immune from such a civil lawsuit? It's not a theoretical question, because recently, Donald J. Trump accused former President Obama of tapping Trump's phones without any evidence at all. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this time it's about presidential immunity.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
If you're old enough to remember the 1990s, you're old enough to remember that presidents can be sued and that those lawsuits can have very serious consequences. I'm speaking, of course, of President Bill Clinton and the civil lawsuit that was filed against him by Paula Jones. Paula Jones alleged that when he had been governor of Arkansas, that Clinton had sexually harassed her. In a very controversial decision, the United States Supreme Court allowed that case to go forward, which ultimately led to President Clinton's impeachment. But that case was based upon conduct that had occurred before President Clinton was sworn in. Can you sue a president for something he does while he's president? Well, the answer is not quite as clear as you might think. So thank heaven we've got our First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie, to explain it to us.
My name is Doug McKechnie, and I teach law at the United States Air Force Academy.
They haven't fired you yet.
They haven't. Unfortunately, I've been staying under the radar, as it were.
You've been exceeding expectations for months now. I took a bet with somebody. I forget who it was. I didn't figure you'd last a year there.
They haven't found a way to get rid of me yet.
That's just remarkable that an ACLU guy like you would find such a welcoming home at a place that has a reputation for being very, very conservative. So well done. Well done. What are we talking about today?
Today, we're talking about presidential immunity. The topic's been in the news a lot lately, but unlike some of the discussion revolving around immunity from criminal prosecution, there's also a question of whether or not the president could be or is immune from civil liability.
Okay. Let me state broadly my general understanding of this issue, and then you can tell me how wrong I am or what particulars I might have skimmed over. But my general understanding is that when it comes to civil lawsuits, that the president, by and large, is not immune, that you can sue the president either for something that happened before he was president, certainly for something that happened before he was president, and maybe even for something that happened during his presidency, as long as it was not in conjunction with his official duties. But then whatever court you file your lawsuit in has the discretion either to allow the suit to go forward or to stay it until after the term is up. And that's my general understanding.
That's generally true. There are really two cases that have dealt with this topic. The first one was the first time the Supreme Court ever considered the case was a case against President Nixon. And a federal employee had filed a lawsuit and alleged that President Nixon was part of a scheme to get rid of him, to wrongfully terminate him in retaliation for some testimony that he gave to Congress. Mm-hmm. And that was really the first time that the Supreme Court was faced with this question of whether or not a president was entitled to immunity for the actions that he or she takes while in office or takes within the what the court calls the outer perimeter of his official duties.
Right. And the general idea in that case, and was that, what was the name of that? Was that Fitzgerald? Was that the name of that case?
It was. It was Nixon versus Fitzgerald.
Right. And the court decided that that was part of the president's official duties, or at least the allegations went to his official duties. And therefore, they said he's pretty much absolutely immune from any such lawsuit because they didn't want presidents to worry about getting sued for whatever decisions they might make in office. Is that pretty much where they went?
It is. It's interesting. I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that specifically says that the president has immunity in any way. So really, this is a judicial construct, meaning that the court created this immunity for a president out of a public policy motivation. And so the court said, we really need presidents to be able to have some flexibility, to be able to operate without fear of litigation and liability, so long as they're acting within their official capacity or taking part in their official duties.
Yeah, you're right. There's nothing in Article 2 about that, and there's nothing generally in the Constitution about it. But the concept itself was not completely novel because, of course, we know that there are a number of government officials, notably prosecutors, also have immunity from lawsuits dealing with a lot of their actions. And on a similar theory, the theory is that we don't want prosecutors to be constantly worried that by charging a certain person, they might find themselves as defendants in a civil suit. We want people to do their jobs and focus on their jobs. And certainly the president has the most important job in the country. So the logic is the same. But that still leaves out there at least the two potentialities. One of them is that the president gets sued for something he did before he was president, and that's actually arisen a couple of times. And the other one, at least in theory, is possible, and that is that the president does something while he's in office, but it's not part of his official duties. And I say it's only in theory possible because, especially these days, it's almost impossible to imagine the president doing anything that couldn't somehow be characterized as being part of his official duties. The example I will give in class is that, okay, imagine the president just gets tired of living in his bubble and he uses his secret presidential escape tunnel to go out and emerge on the far side of Lafayette Park, leaving the Secret Service behind, and then he simply goes down the street and starts, you know, punching people. That's not a good example because that's criminal. Or let's say he goes and he negligently causes someone harm, and that person then wants to sue the president. Well, in that very strange example and very unlikely example, one might argue the president really had exited his bubble and was doing something outside of his official duties. But unless he did something that extreme, almost anything the president does while in office would be probably considered part of his official duties. And therefore, that possibility of him being sued for something he does while in office is a pretty remote one. Do you agree with that?
I think so. And the question really comes down to this this idea of what actions. So when the Supreme Court created this this immunity, it did perceive or did suggest that if not explicitly, then implicitly suggest that there could be some actions that fall outside of this, what it calls the outer perimeter of official duties. So theoretically, there could be actions that the president takes that are not within his official capacity and therefore would open him up to liability. One of the cases, Clinton versus Jones, that gave rise to ultimately the Monica Lewinsky scandal, was just one of those cases where President Clinton was forced to litigate a case against him when he was sued while he was president, but he was sued for things that happened before he was president.
Yeah, that's the key in the Paula Jones case. Even though ultimately the Monica Lewinsky stuff all got wrapped into that because, of course, that's where the discovery led, and those things did happen while the president was in office. The basis for the lawsuit was an alleged sexual harassment claim that had originated back when he was governor of Arkansas. So that would be sort of case number two. And I guess that's what I was trying to say, is that it's just very, very unlikely, it seems to me, that there is anything that a president could do outside the outer perimeter of his official duties while he's in office. But definitely the president can be sued for something he did right up to the day before he's inaugurated.
Sure. So the question arises, what, if anything, could the president be sued for? And probably one of the things that President Trump engages in quite often, and one of the things that causes us to think about or one thing we may think about with regard to lawsuits against President Trump is his use of Twitter and whether or not his use of Twitter could lead to some civil liability or some claim for civil liability, and whether his use of Twitter could somehow fall outside of the outer perimeter of his official duties and then open him up to liability.
Do you think it could?
I think it's possible. And uh-huh. It's not just President Trump. It really could be any president who engages in some sort of activity that falls out outside of the outer perimeter of his official duties. As your listeners probably know, President Trump is pretty active on Twitter. He's been using it for quite a while. And his tweets range from complimentary to insulting, from unabashed to measured. But it's most often his really aggressive and brash tweets that have garnered the most attention.
So you mean only the most offensive 98% of his tweets?
It seems to be.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to be partisan, but I mean, it's almost every time I see anything. Certainly, the tweets that make the news are the ones where he's doing precisely what you describe. So, despite what I just said before, that it would take an extreme circumstance for the president to step outside of his official duties, outside that outer perimeter of his official duties, you're thinking perhaps it's possible that our current president, through his tweeting and some of the more extreme things that he has said in his tweets, may actually cross that line.
Well, you know, it's possible. I mean, and I think that when we think about this absolute immunity doctrine and the idea that it is judicially created, we need to think about what actions the president could engage in that might take him outside of his official duties or might take him outside of this protection. And certainly there are presidential actions when taken that implicate other constitutional principles. So let me give you an example of what I'm thinking about. So, for example, Article 2 gives the commander in chief a lot of power with regard to the military, obviously, and gives the president a lot of power with regard to the military. But that power is not in a vacuum. And Congress has Article 1 authority to declare war. And so there's this maybe not a conflict, but one power informs the other. One part of the Constitution informs the other. And certainly with regard to President Trump's tweets or any president's tweets or any president's communication, it doesn't stand alone as a constitutional question with regard to presidential immunity. There are other constitutional concepts that are implicated, for example, the First Amendment and defamation, if that was a lawsuit that was brought against President Trump or any other president.
Okay, very interesting. So it's not simply the medium. I mean, Twitter is something relatively new, and certainly this president likes to tweet a lot more than any of his predecessors certainly ever have. In fact, I don't seem to recall that President Obama ever tweeted, or if he did, it was once or twice. But it's not that conduit that triggers this potential stepping beyond the outer limits of presidential authority. Or exercise of power, it's the content of those messages. Is that correct?
Well, I think it is the content, and I think it's the conduit or it's the medium that certainly may cause us to rethink presidential immunity or revisit it or reconsider it from the perspective of, for example, a defamation claim. Twitter perhaps just exacerbates some of the issues that we see with regard to communication from any elected official, whether the president or otherwise. So maybe Twitter just gives us an opportunity to sort of reconsider the way that elected officials communicate, particularly with regard to the kind of communication that it facilitates, often pretty it can be aggressive, it can be pretty negative, it can even be profound and malicious. So there's all sorts of ways that Twitter facilitates communication, but certainly that sort of disconnected nature of Twitter allows people to communicate in ways that that weren't very common 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Well, certainly one aspect of it that one reads about in the press, of course, I have no personal knowledge of this, is that people have tried repeatedly to pry that smartphone out of the president's hand, and they simply can't get it away from him. It's one thing to have to go down to the Situation Room at the White House to, you know, to actually speak on a secure phone to somebody. Perhaps that sort of enhances or encourages reflection, whereas, you know, your smartphone sitting on the bedside table next to you at 2 a.m. is something you can just pick up and start poking at with your thumbs. Before we get to that, though, one other aspect of this just occurred to me, and I think I might be maybe starting to agree with you a little bit. If I recall correctly, I don't follow the president specifically, but occasionally I'll see reprints of one of his tweets. That's a personal Twitter account, isn't it? It's at Real Donald Trump.
So, well, he has two Twitter accounts.
Okay.
And so the one Twitter account has been around since about 2009, and that one is at Real Donald Trump. He took over the at POTUS account when he was inaugurated. So he really is running two accounts at the same time. And indeed, he's actually posted tweets from both accounts within hours of each other. And so he will post a tweet from at Real Donald Trump, and then within an hour, he'll post a tweet from at POTUS. And so he really uses them almost interchangeably. You'll often
He does. But maybe that'd be a basis. I mean, if we want to explore the idea, has this president stepped beyond whatever limit there is to his presidential power? Maybe that's a good dividing line to think of. Kevin. I'm just thinking of it out loud here. Many people will have official Twitter presences or, you know, business Twitter accounts or Facebook accounts, but then they'll have a personal one as well. And certainly I think most people think of them as being separate things, even though they might not be as careful as they should be about keeping them separate. But they do think of them in a different way. Could we say that about this president, that if something comes off his POTUS account, maybe that is more arguably official, but at the @RealDonaldTrump account, it's more arguably private?
It's difficult to say, because if you look through some of the tweets that he's posted from each account, the @RealDonaldTrump account often has issues about policy or reflections on government. And similarly, if you look at the @POTUS account, sometimes they're a little bit more personal posts. But certainly, for example, the @RealDonaldTrump account is the one that he posted the tweet about President Obama allegedly wiretapping Trump Tower. And so if that was untrue, and if it comes from the @RealDonaldTrump account, the question is, he's alleging that a former president committed a crime, misused the intelligence services. Is that something that could open him up to litigation for a defamation claim?
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this time we're speaking with Doug McKechnie, our First Amendment guy, and he's talking about something a little bit different, presidential immunity from civil lawsuits. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and we'll come back and speak some more with Doug, and after that, we'll have an update with our good buddy Chris Phillips all about, well, democracy and stuff. Now let's do a constitutional quiz, yet another one recorded at Vilnius University in Lithuania.
Well, who are you, young lady?
Hello, I'm Julia.
Julia? And you said hello.
Yeah.
Okay, and hello suggests to me, dass Sie Deutsch sind.
Genau.
Genau. Und woher kommen Sie?
Aus Münster.
Aus Münster. Okay, we got to stop with the German stuff. Nobody can understand us back there in America. So you are German and you come from a town called Münster?
Yes.
And where is Münster?
In the western part, close to the Netherlands.
Close to the Netherlands?
Yes.
Okay. And what brings you to Vilnius, of all places?
Erasmus. I do Erasmus. And I wanted to go to a place which I have no knowledge of. So I went to Lithuania.
You have no knowledge at all of Lithuania?
I didn't have, yeah. Not okay. A lot, yes.
What have you learned about Lithuania?
A lot. Yeah.
A lot. Okay. Could you elaborate just a little bit on that?
I don't know. Like, I learned a lot about the people, that they seem to be not that open-minded first, but when you try to speak a little bit Lithuanian, then they open up. And about the history, that it was Soviet Union part, and about the food and beers, yeah.
Uh-huh, very good. Well, give us a little bit of lesson in Lithuania. How do you say hello in Lithuanian?
Labas.
Labas. Okay, and how do you say please?
Prašom.
Prašom.
Yes.
Okay, and I know what achu means.
Yeah, that means thank you.
That means thank you. See, I've already learned a little Lithuanian. Yeah. I only been here a day and I already know how to speak the language. Okay. Well, that's very good. So you're learning about a new culture and you're learning about a little bit of a new language. And you're exactly right. When you make an effort to speak somebody else's language, I think that's like telling them, I respect you.
Yes.
And I'm here. I know that I'm the guest. I don't expect you to speak my language. I'm going to speak your language. And I'm afraid that's something that many of my countrymen sometimes overlook. We get so accustomed to the idea that everybody speaks English, we just walk in someplace. You would say?
Yeah, I was an exchange student in America, and I had Spanish lessons there, but I didn't learn Spanish at all. So it was very, very bad.
Next time. Next time I'm sure you'll do it. I just happened to spend a couple of days in Munich, and a few years back I spent some time in Berlin, and I used my old college German and tried to speak to people. And when I was in Munich recently, my wife laughed every time I would try to speak German with people, because I'd get about two sentences in and then they'd start speaking English back to me because they could tell very quickly that I was an American. And yet I could always tell that they appreciated that I was making the effort.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's why I kept doing it, partly also because it's kind of fun. You don't get much opportunity to practice your German back in the United States. But It's just fun to do that, and it also just shows a great respect. So that's really quite a lesson you've learned. But you're actually studying American government here.
Yes.
So here is your question.
Okay.
What country has the oldest operating written constitution in the world?
The United States.
The United States, but we're such yes. a young country. How could that be?
Because most of the time people had kings earlier.
Yeah.
For example, the American states, they made an independent war from England, and then they had their constitution afterwards.
So it really was kind of a new thing 230 years ago for people to get together and actually try to write their own constitution. Okay, now here's the real question.
Okay.
What country has the second oldest written constitution?
Lithuania.
Lithuania. Okay, so you have been paying attention and you have learned it. They've actually changed their constitution a great deal in the 20th century, but they came up with their own written constitution, I think in 1790, was it?
91.
91, right, about the same time we were adopting our Bill of Rights. They were doing that. So lots of commonality there. Well, thank you very much for taking our quiz.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your time. All right.
The president has offered no evidence whatsoever to back up these allegations, these very serious allegations that the former president was essentially spying on him. He said, I bet a good lawyer could make a great case out of the fact that President Obama was tapping my phones in October just prior to election. Now, again, President Trump calls this a fact. It's not an established fact. There's been no proof offered.
Each week, the Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris. And in case you're just joining us, I'll mention that this week our guest is Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy, who is telling us about a very interesting subject that's been much in the news over the past few months, presidential immunity. Can you sue the president if he says something about you that either isn't true or for which he simply has no evidence at all? It's generally the burden of a person who's asserting immunity to demonstrate that he should have immunity. And I think that might undercut the president's claim of immunity if he did have a private account and he was using it in some sense carelessly, you know, mixing and matching, using it sometimes for official tweets, sometimes for less official tweets. So if the burden would be on him to assert this immunity, perhaps he would have undercut himself by having these two accounts and using them interchangeably.
I think that's a possibility. I think that that's certainly something that is a factor to consider. Again, this idea of presidential immunity is a judicial construct. And when we're thinking about this judicial construct, we have to think about it from a public policy perspective. And so there's really no specific answer to this question in the Constitution. And so we have to think about if the president intermingles these two Twitter accounts in a way that makes them indistinguishable, is he somehow opening himself up to piercing this privilege that he would otherwise have.
Yeah, and you're using this concept of privilege as well. And again, generally, if I want to assert a privilege, whether it's evidentiary, some other immunity privilege, whatever it is, it's my burden, and it's my burden to protect it. And if he's not been protecting it, he could have undercut himself. But I don't mean to beat that dead horse. You keep moving toward this defamation thing, and I think you want to talk about that. Let's explore that a little bit. Let's go back. So it was on his real Donald Trump account, so arguably his private account that's pre-existed the presidency, that he alleged that the former president had committed a crime by wiretapping Trump Tower. An allegation for which, as far as I can tell, there is absolutely no evidence. And in fact, there have been multiple denials from everybody involved in that circumstance. You think that might give rise to a defamation claim by the former president?
I wonder. I wonder if it's a possibility. There have been other instances where President Trump has used sort of insulting or allegedly negative language through his Twitter account. He has alleged that Amazon, the company, doesn't pay taxes.
Actually, the allegation I heard was that they don't pay internet taxes, which is interesting because there is no such thing. thing.
Right. One can assume that what he meant was that they're not paying their state taxes.
That would be an assumption. I don't know. Maybe they aren't. Maybe there is a secret internet tax I'm not aware of. But that's interesting,
and then
too.
It wouldn't be against the law to not pay it because it doesn't exist.
Yeah, that would undercut the defamation claim, wouldn't it?
Sure. He's also referred to news hosts as getting medical procedures that they potentially didn't get. And so there's various things that he has said that may or may not be true and may or may not be injurious to someone's reputation. And so the question is if the president is using Twitter to insult people and maybe injure their reputation, could that take those comments outside of his official duties? When might it take it outside of his official duties and open him up to liability for that defamation?
Well, I think I know what you're going to say next, but go ahead and tell me, what would be the standard? Let's say Donald Trump, I'll give you a hypo, let's make it nice and clear. Donald Trump says that Stuart Harris likes to torture little kitties with forks. Okay, and he's got no evidence that I do this, and by the way, I don't do that. So let's just assume that this is untrue and there's no factual support for it. He does it on his @RealDonaldTrump account. Can I then sue the president? What would be the standard that I would have to meet to do that?
Well, I think this is where we have to look to other constitutional principles. And I think you mentioned, you probably have a sense of where I'm going. There is this concept, the only time the Supreme Court has ever really looked at this idea, or maybe the first time the court has looked at this idea of defamation and whether or not defamation being speech, how defamation is affected by the First Amendment. The court in this case, New York Times versus Sullivan, a very famous case, said when a person is speaking, typically a citizen or non-public official, when he or she is talking about a public official, an elected official, and maybe defames that person, the elected official, if they want to sue for defamation, they've got to prove a standard called actual malice. And that's knowledge that the statement that the citizen who made the comment was perhaps a critical comment of a public official, that citizen knew that the statement was false or acted with reckless disregard as to whether it was false.
Mm-hmm. That is the standard, but that's the reverse of what we've got here, because that would be Donald Trump suing me for defaming him. But if I understood you correctly, you're wondering what happens if Donald Trump is actually the defendant in a circumstance and a defendant in a lawsuit. So I wouldn't have to meet that standard, would I?
Yeah. So that makes me think. So what? Why did the court? Why did the court carve out and sort of create this big protective bubble for speech? And the court said, well, we need in New York Times versus Sullivan, we need a lot of breathing room so that people can criticize their elected officials. The court said, but we're not going to go so far as to allow people to say whatever they want. And so the one kind of defamation that will not be protected by the First Amendment is malicious defamation. And so to the extent that a president sort of transcends the bounds of his official duties and leaves that outer perimeter of his official duties, certainly if defamation was malicious defamation, that's a type of speech that the Supreme Court said it would never protect, or it would never put the First Amendment shield around. And so certainly if someone made an allegation for malicious defamation against the president, that might be a situation where the president leaves that outer perimeter of his official duties and enters into a place where he could be sued.
Okay, so you're combining these concepts in a very interesting way, and that's I compliment you on this. So if the president is not the plaintiff, if I'm the plaintiff, and normally speaking, as a private individual, there's no particular constitutionality or constitutionalization of my cause of action. But you're saying that this concept of malicious defamation, which the Supreme Court said was not going to be subject to First Amendment protection, we might lift it out of New York Times versus Sullivan, and we might use it to address the question of whether the president has gone beyond the bounds of his official duties. So if the president is not merely commenting about politics or about policy or something, but he simply singles me or, I don't know, Joe Scarborough or somebody else out there and makes false allegations of it, or even a former president who's now a private citizen and makes false allegations about him, that concept might be used to say that's something he doesn't have immunity for.
Exactly. And we see this concept in other constitutional areas. So, for example, in the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause, we see where the government has tried to single out groups of people. In the past 20 years, these groups of people have been gay and lesbian people. The government has tried to single them out and create laws that injure them in some way. The court said when those laws, when government action is motivated by nothing other than animus for a particular person or for a group of person, those kinds of laws transcend what is available to the government with regard to the kind of policy that it can implement. And so we see this idea that when the government acts with animus, malice, whatever word you want to use, these are synonyms really of each other, it has no constitutional power to act in that way. And so the Constitution really cabins the government. The Constitution says we have a limited government. And the Constitution says that the government, whether it's the president or whether it's the legislative branch, really only has limited power to act. And in other contexts, the court has said the government can't take actions when the actions are only motivated by a sort of a hatred or a malicious intent.
Well, Doug, I have to give you a compliment. Is that this is your idea? This is the focus of your law review article you recently presented?
It is.
That's a cool idea. What you've done here is you've taken a concept from several disparate areas, from the law of defamation, when there's a public official as the plaintiff, from the law of equal protection that involved a statewide referendum, if you're referring to the Colorado decision, that was motivated by animus. That's the Romer versus Evan decision. And you have said this can be generalized and that government cannot act simply maliciously. And I guess the relevant term we would talk about is that it's irrational. It fails the lowest level of judicial scrutiny that's available to the government. So by acting with this animus, the government's not going to pass this lowest level test of acting with a rational, a legitimate purpose. That might be something we can apply to the concept of presidential immunity as well.
Yeah, it seems to me that if someone wanted to make an allegation for against a president, any president, it's not just President Trump, but any president, for speaking in a way that specifically is done with a purpose to injure, a really sort of morally culpable speech uttered only to injure someone's reputation, uttered in bad faith, that seems to me, both under the First Amendment and under other amendments, to be the kind of government action that would go outside of or transcend the boundaries of what the Constitution allows the government to do. And so if that's the case, then it seems to me that that would also take the president's action outside of what would otherwise be protected activity into this sort of no man's land of unprotected constitutional activity.
That is really a fascinating concept. Again, I compliment you on thinking about that, Doug. That's an interesting concept because we often hear people say, typically the president's opponents, that what he's doing, well, not always though, oftentimes a lot of his fellow Republicans will say that he is violating existing norms, that what he's doing has not been done, that nobody, he's engaging in name calling, he's engaging in vicious, nasty behavior that, you know, often is counterproductive to his own political interests, that he's lashing out at people at 3 a.m. on his Twitter account. And you're saying that might not simply be a political judgment. It might actually implicate the constitutional question in the judicially created concept of the presidential immunity. So just as the public might recoil at some of the things the president's doing and saying, a courtroom, a judge might say, this is beyond the pale. This, I will not give you protection. I will not give you immunity for having defamed Stuart Harris this way or Joe Scarborough or former President Obama.
Sure. And it seems to further the whole idea behind the First Amendment and the New York Times versus Sullivan case, which the court suggested we need citizens in a democracy to be able to criticize public officials. If you allow a president to have presidential immunity for malicious defamation, you're really going to have a situation where the president can chill the speech of critics by threatening to sue them for defamation, but they would not be able to reciprocate if the president defames them.
Yeah, so what's good for the gander's good for the goose. In fact, now that I'm thinking of it even more, if the president wants to sue me, he has to meet a high standard of maliciousness. But if he does, then he can sue me. He can sue me if I have intentionally said something false about him or if I acted with reckless disregard and I thereby damaged him. He could sue me for defamation. What you're saying is if he does the same thing to me, well, I can sue him too.
That's true. And certainly this chilling effect can be all the more palpable when you have a president who's well known for threatening or indeed engaging in lawsuits for defamation.
Yep. In fact, again, I'm just thinking about the argument, thinking out loud here. The president might very well be attempting to silence critics or potential critics by scaring them off. I mean, the message, if he's, I keep mentioning Joe Scarborough because he's the fellow on the television broadcast Morning Joe on MSNBC, I think it is, and he's married to a woman or about to be married to a woman, his co-host, Mika, and I forget her last name. At any rate, he recently started calling them names, and I don't know that he actually made any factual allegations about them, but regardless, he has directed his ire toward them, and perhaps the message is, don't mess with me, Donald Trump, because if you do, I'm going to call you out and I'm going to call you names, and I might even allege that you've done something inappropriate like failure to pay taxes or wiretapping or something. That could be seen by a court as a misuse of presidential power and something that negatively impacts our democratic system of government, and therefore the president should not be allowed to get away with it.
And so that requires the court, and that requires us as citizens to think about, in that situation, is that the kind of immunity, is that the kind of protection that we have given to the president with his Article II powers to be able to effectuate policy and the government's actions? Is that the kind of immunity that we've provided to the president through the Constitution?
Fascinating question, fascinating issue. So where do you come down? I mean, do you ultimately think that there is a point? Give me a circumstance where you think that the president may very well have exceeded the bounds of his official duties and therefore exposed himself to a lawsuit by somebody like me.
So one of the situations might be the one we talked about earlier, where President Trump alleged that President Obama engaged in illegal wiretaps. That certainly would be a situation where he's claiming that the previous president engaged in unlawful activity. Any kind of defamation that suggests that someone engaged in unlawful activity, typically, so long as that allegation is false, that's ripe for a defamation claim. Certainly calling James Comey a leaker, if in fact that's not true. There are different situations that you could imagine any president really lashing out at a critic and making allegations about that person that suggests that they engaged in criminal activity, if found to be untrue, would be injurious to their reputation.
So I'm sure former President Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama are regular listeners. There's no question in my mind. So so if they were to call you up and ask you to represent them in that case, you going to take it?
I think I'd refer them to a better attorney than me.
Well, I don't know if I can think of anybody any better than you in this one. And again, I congratulate you on coming up with this very interesting combination, synthesis of several different constitutional concepts and pulling out the common thread there and applying it in a novel way to this issue of presidential immunity. Okay. Well, Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy, do you want to give your standard disclaimer?
Sure. My views are my own and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the United States government.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've just finished a really interesting interview with our First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie of the U.S. Air Force Academy. Thanks very much, Doug. We appreciate that very, very much. After the break, we will have a change of pace. We will come back, and we will speak to our buddy Chris Phillips of the Declaration Project, of Socrates Cafe, of democracycafe.org. He just does all sorts of interesting things, and he's long overdue to give us an update. Stick around. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now let's speak with our buddy Chris Phillips and see what sort of democratic stuff he's been up to.
I'm Christopher Phillips, the founder of the nonprofit group Democracy Cafe, probably best known for its longtime signature initiative, Socrates Cafe, but starting to gain steam with our other initiatives, the many constitutional conventions that we hold around the fruited plain called Constitution Cafe, and also our newest initiative called Democracy Cafe, A System Unrigged.
That all sounds fascinating. But before we go on, full disclosure, I'm on your advisory board, and we go back a number of years. You have been on the show several times. So for the uninitiated, tell us a little bit more about your background. I think the first one you came out with, the first book you wrote that was relevant to all of this, and I think the way that I met you was the first one was Constitution Cafe, wasn't it?
Yes, the first one that was relevant to this. I'm probably best known for my first book, Socrates Cafe, A
Fresh Taste
of Philosophy.
Right, Socrates Cafe, right.
Yeah, but Constitution Cafe, I began that about a decade after I first started Socrates Cafe because people wanted to talk politics all of a sudden.
Well, let's go all the way back. Let's go back to the beginning. What was Socrates Cafe, and then we'll come into Constitution Cafe.
Okay, well, Socrates Cafe began during the second term of the Clinton administration when he was undergoing impeachment proceedings. Americans were so woefully polarized. And I thought, you know, I have dual Greek U.S. citizenship, and I'm a student of ancient Athens democracy. And I thought, you know, if people cannot engage thoughtfully yet passionately with one another in the public sphere, if all they can do it is engage in this sort of pernicious knockdown, drag out one-upmanship, then all is lost. And so I thought I'd better try to do something in my modest way to remedy that. And so I began holding in public places and spaces Socrates Cafe, looking into timely and timeless philosophical questions with people who typically wouldn't get together with one another. And lo and behold, it turns out that they could thoughtfully engage, that the idea was to steer away from argument and debate, not so people would walk on eggshells, but so they could first forge uncommon ground by just seeing maybe how their philosophies intersect, even as they differ on maybe concrete solutions.
Wait a minute. You're Greek?
I am Greek. I'm a Greek citizen. You haven't seen my passport, bro?
I have never seen you. I didn't. In fact, you know, I guess I was just misled by your surname, Phillips. I just didn't.
How do you think I get to Cuba with my U.S. passport? Are you kidding me? I used the old Greek passport.
I had no idea. So you come by the Socrates stuff, honestly.
I come by it with extraordinarily honest lineage. My grandmother, my yaya, used to exhort me as she would painfully tweak my cheek to go out one day and sort of repeat the feat of Socrates in modern context. She immigrated through Ellis Island in the early 20s, and she became the first Greek teacher in the Tampa Bay region, teaching Greek language and culture.
I didn't know that, so this is on your mom's side.
You see, Stuart, that's why you have to keep having me on.
I do, because I just find out more fascinating things. So what was your mom's surname?
So this was on my dad's side.
Oh, he changed his name.
Their surname was Philippou. It was summarily changed to Phillips by an Ellis Island bureaucrat. So I get my love of all things Greek from that side. I get my love of all things questioning, honestly. You mentioned my mom from my mom's side. She was born and raised in a coal mining camp in Appalachia, not all that far from where you're based.
Right.
So she was ostracized for relentlessly asking questions, not as an end in itself, but just to sate her limitless curiosity. And so both of those aspects, my dad's and my mom's side, really imprinted with me at a pretty young age.
I think we're proving your thesis here. The more people talk to each other, the more they find common ground, even though I don't think I have any Greek connections. Certainly the Appalachian one is there. Okay, well, that was Socrates Cafe. You wrote a book. You held these cafes. You talked about political dialogue and non-political dialogue, finding common ground. And then that morphed into another book called Constitution Cafe. And you did the same thing with a constitutional focus, right?
I did. I mean, my two sort of heroes growing up, though they were flawed and foibled human beings, were Socrates and Thomas Jefferson. You know, I went to William & Mary, took some classes supposedly in the same classroom where he did. And he had this idea that we should never rest on the laurels of our iconic founders and framers, that we, the human heart and mind, should progress, and that we should better them. And that the Constitution that we have should be a reflection of our higher angels. And again, once again, at a time when people were now divided, you know, with a Democrat president, Obama, I thought maybe the Constitution could be the mecca that could bring us back together by putting it under both the microscope and magnifying glass. So I did. I traveled all over America, middle America, far left America, New England, asking people if you could put on a framer's hat and fulfill Jefferson's wish of radically changing the Constitution if we so chose every generation, what would you change and why? And could we actually come up with near universal consensus on what those changes would be? So I did that as someone who hadn't read the Constitution very deeply, as frankly, Stuart, no offense to lawyers, but many of them haven't either.
Oh, no, none taken. In fact, that's one of the great holes, yeah, I think, in legal education. In fact, I was shocked to realize not too long ago that there are some law schools out there that don't even require that one takes constitutional law, which just blew my mind. But
it's chilling.
It's astonishing, really. I mean, that is a subject that's tested on the bar, but it's one thing to learn about the Constitution in a bar review course and get the bare minimum you need to pass an exam. And it's quite another to really think about it the way that I like to, and I know that you do as well. So no offense taken in that regard. So you did Constitution Cafe. You traveled the country. Yeah. We've talked about
Speaking of bars, you know, we did it at the Green Dragon Tavern, where some of the original Sons of Liberty gathered way back when. So, you know, the idea, really, I think in everything I do is to kind of resuscitate that rabble-rousing spirit of 76 in a way, in a constructive way, in a way that's really supposed to help us more bring the promise of what our founding fathers and mothers risked it all for, to bring it more in alignment into practice. Because right now, bro, we're ossifying. We are ossifying and probably in a period of decline, even though we may not recognize it. And I think it may be exemplified by the pernicious politics that's being practiced today. This is not woe is me-ism. This is about, if anybody is going to resuscitate things and turn things around, it's going to be we the people. It's not going to be these, you know, powers that be who are running them.
Indeed, it's not just going to be we the people, but as you and I have discussed in the past, and as you've also subsequently written about, you're very much a person who is in favor of extending political rights pretty far down the chain. I mean, you are very much in favor of involving children in the political process, and you've even written on that. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I will say this. In my latest travels, typically at libraries across America, which are libraries are greatest bastions of democratic inclusiveness. People of all ages and walks of life feel comfortable coming there. And I've been holding these dialogues, these inquiries that include a healthy smattering of people of all ages. Many of them have proposed spontaneously that we lower the voting age at least around 15 or 16, because suddenly it would make schools the nexus of democratic participation at a time when the administrators are cutting out civics education. They're replacing it with programs on how to code at a time when we need to be coding for democracy. So by lowering the voting age somewhat, rather than putting it at 18, when kids are suddenly getting ready to make dramatic changes in their lives, going on, you know, to real responsibilities, whether it's going to college, lower it a couple of years at least, at a time when they can really immerse and involve themselves in civic affairs. And that also puts the schools at the very nexus of democratic participation. This was proposed at a recent gathering I held at Tacoma Park, Maryland Public Library. The very next day, I was holding another one of these in New England, you know, land of the town meeting, where there's really direct civic participation. And a person there had come all the way up from Hyattsville, Maryland, and had taken part of it. She was visiting relatives there just on vacation. She said that they had lowered the age to 16 at Hyattsville, Maryland, and that it had a dramatic impact on students really diving in and digging in and making the schools itself just suddenly this web of great civic participation. So, you know, people, I'm certainly not the first one to propose this. Nancy Pelosi came out in favor of it. A Democratic congressman, now retired, Vasconcelos in California, had long been an advocate of it. But by lowering it at least somewhat, I do believe that kids' immersion and involvement would make them a formidable voting bloc. So maybe there actually would be more of a drive towards creating some sort of humane healthcare program, some sort of really decent education program. So Lots of kids could attend the kinds of quality schools that many of the richer folk can take for granted. I think kids can show us the way. Also, there's a civility among our youngest that has totally gone by the wayside. It's really easy to criticize the president as the demeanor in chief, but I've seen people all across the political spectrum also wage with all their passionate and destructive and poisonous might into the same kind of really polluting, demeaning labeling that's taking place. Kids can show us the way out of this. I absolutely am convinced of this, not by some sort of theorizing, but just based on my experiences engaging with them and what I call democratizing, looking at key issues that face us today and respectfully engaging one another, listening to one another.
We've discussed this before. You and I have discussed this before, Chris, and as you know, I've been skeptical when it talks about, when you have talked about extending political rights to people who are less than 18 years old. In fact, I've expressed some certain degree of reluctance even to allow an 18 or 19 or 20-year-old to vote. In fact, I think there are times when I think you shouldn't be allowed to vote till you're at least 30 or so, because I see so much immature behavior out there. But having said that, and having said that that's my initial, my starting point, I have thought about this over the years. And while I might still question the judgment of younger people, and I don't like to think of myself as being, having exactly the same vote as a 15-year-old. On the other hand, you're still talking about a subset of society, so maybe the potential for danger is not as high as I thought it was, and the potential for, as you say, democratizing them or activating them or getting them involved early in the process, maybe that counterbalances it. Because I recall my own experience or non-experience with student government in high school, and I never got involved because it didn't do anything. It had no power. It was a make-believe. There was nothing to it. And I think a lot of people feel that way, but real government, participating in real issues, getting to vote in real elections as a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old, that might have, if nothing else, a really good educational effect.
That is my operating premise. Stuart, I have to also say at this point, what do we have to lose?
I know you've got a rather dystopian view of the current American democracy.
It's not dystopian. I do believe, though, that without in slightest way being Pollyannish, that our youngest are better practitioners of a respectful politics, that it would behoove us older folks to practice it. Look, it's not just Trump who's engaging in the most humiliating, demeaning, pernicious labeling possible. You've got people on the left doing it too. If anybody who goes to Andy Borowitz's Facebook page, it's not just humor. There's a lot of really degrading labeling on his part too, and tens of thousands of his acolytes too like what he does by calling people the most horrendous things who see things from a different bent. Again, I think that bringing people into the political sphere at a younger age might actually help us adults be a little bit more on our P's and Q's.
Well, Chris, I hope you're right. I always hope you're right, even when I sometimes think maybe you're not. At any rate, thanks for being on the show, and thanks also to our First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy, for telling us all about presidential immunity from civil lawsuits. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.